Les conférences du Collège de France.
Mesdames, Messieurs, bonjour à toutes et à tous. Bienvenue au Collège de France pour cette conférence qui sera donnée à notre grand plaisir par Michael Doyle, qui est professeur de droit international et de relations internationales à l'Université de Columbia à New York. Il parlera anglais, mais je parle français puisqu'il comprend très bien le français aussi. Avant de devenir professeur à Columbia, Michael a été professeur à l'Université de Warwick, au Royaume-Uni, à Johns Hopkins, à l'Université de Princeton et à l'Université de Yale, aux États-Unis. Michael Doyle compte, et vous le savez si vous êtes là aujourd'hui, parmi les spécialistes les plus influents de la théorie des relations internationales, et notamment de la sécurité internationale, de la paix, des migrations et du constitutionnalisme global. Ses travaux sur l'impérialisme, notamment, ont fait date, et sa connaissance très intime des rouages internes de la politique onusienne, combinée avec ses intérêts théoriques pour la théorie de la paix et de la justice globale, notamment celle de Kant, en font un penseur uniquement situé, très avisé et toujours très informé des relations internationales. Alors, parmi ses publications qui sont extrêmement nombreuses, je citerai celles qui m'ont le plus frappée et qui aujourd'hui encore font date: Empires, Ways of War and Peace, Satano Lectures de 2006, Striking First, Preemption and Prevention in International Conflict, Liberal Peace, Selected Essays, The Question of Intervention, John Stuart Mill and the Responsibility to Protect, et Cold Peace, Avoiding the New Cold War. Il a également publié de nombreux articles qui ont fait date, chapitres, livres, essais, et j'en mentionnerai deux ici: Kant, ça sera très important ici aujourd'hui, Liberal Legacies and Foreign Affairs, dans Philosophy and Public Affairs, et Liberalism and World Politics, dans The American Political Science Review. De 2001 à 2003, Michael Doyle a été sous-secrétaire général et conseiller spécial du secrétaire général des Nations Unies, Kofi Annan, et dans le cadre de ses responsabilités au sein du bureau exécutif du secrétaire général à l'époque, se trouvaient notamment la planification stratégique avec les objectifs du millénaire pour le développement, la responsabilisation des entreprises internationales avec le pacte mondial et les relations avec Washington. Toutes ces choses ont marqué évidemment les relations internationales et le droit international. Alors ce matin, Michael Doyle nous propose une conférence sur le thème « More than just peace », qui est devenu « Just peace, a conversation with John Rawls », dans laquelle il va revenir sur les théories de la paix juste, de Rawls bien sûr, mais aussi de Kant. Mais je n'en dis pas plus. Merci beaucoup d'avoir accepté notre invitation, cher Michael. And now, you can continue in English, of course. Thank you.
Merci beaucoup. Merci beaucoup. Thank you for such a kind and generous introduction, Professor Besson. It's a true honor for me to be here. I thank her. I also am especially appreciative of all of you who have joined us this morning on such a beautiful day outside. I hesitate to remind you of how lovely it is outside, but it is lovely outside, and it's kind of you to come in and participate in our conversation today. I also want to acknowledge Professor Mireille Delmas-Marty, a friend and colleague in the Collegium. I see some colleagues here from that. It's an honor to be speaking in her room. She was a great scholar and a great citizen of France. I'll also thank Abdella Al-Haroun, Bhavna Rajan for data analysis that I'll share with you a little bit as we go into this. And so that's my thanks. For my apologies, I apologize for speaking in English. French is too beautiful a language for me to slaughter, and so I leave it in all of its glory unpolluted by me this morning. And I also, this is a little awkward, I want to apologize as a U.S. citizen for the actions of our government over the past year and a half. It is a shock to all of us, the depredations, the damage, the malice, the threats to allies, the harm to innocents that this government has engaged in. And I ask you, as fellow citizens of the world, to be patient with we Americans. We hope to restore our best constitutional and democratic traditions legally by election. in the future. In my talk today, I'll be talking a bit with John Rawls. I call it a conversation. It's a one-sided conversation, as some of you will know. He passed away in 1999. And I want to put his work in context. I need to... this is now working, thank you. And I want to put his work on peace into the context of other pieces. He wrote a wonderful book called The Law of Peoples that I'll be focusing on in my comments this morning. But it's in the context of other pieces that I would begin briefly to introduce John Rawls's wonderful work. Some, of course, have claimed that all pieces are the same. Any piece, they're all the same. Churchill, actually Macmillan describing what he once heard Churchill say way back in 1954, said, "Jaw, jaw is always better than wall, wall." And you have to imitate Churchill to have that make any sense. That is, talking, diplomacy is always better than war. But I want to draw some distinctions this morning between unjust pieces, which are coercive and threatening, and just pieces, which are voluntary and mutual. Rawls is certainly of the second sort. Unjust pieces, I'm going to only go over briefly, but I will go over them. Some of them we know well, which I'm not going to mention beyond this. Nuclear mutual assured destruction. That provides peace, but only under circumstances of annihilation as a threat. I'll briefly mention again the balances of power and Machiavelli's rule, and then class conflict and cooperation, Marx on the Civil War in France, another form of a coercive peace, that is until the global socialist revolution takes place. But I'll focus on two just pieces. One, the liberal peace, inspired by Immanuel Kant's Perpetual Peace of 1795, which I'll again mention. And then my theme, a just Rawlsian peace, in aim, in ambition, an effort to create a comprehensively just peace that will include toleration of peoples that liberals typically do not politically tolerate in their international politics. And Rawls includes a duty of assistance, again, which repairs a pathology of liberal politics in which it does not provide adequate assistance to persons in emergency need. And I'll develop both of those themes this morning. Balance of power, briefly. Machiavelli famously in chapter 21 of The Prince said, "You should always balance, don't bandwagon." If there are two smaller states facing a more powerful third state, they should never align with the more powerful state to conquer the other small state, because when they do, they'll be next on the menu. They'll be next consumed. And he made that a powerful insight in his Prince chapter 21. Modern social science scholars, and here I'm drawing on Morton Kaplan, Emerson New, Peter Ordashuk, have developed a model where all states seek to conquer other states in order to be more secure, and they only maintain peace when they're deterred from conquest. That's the idea of the balance of power providing peace. But in order to sustain their argument, they have to make a whole series of assumptions. That is, that the defense and the offense are related to each other one-to-one, so any greater amount of offensive power provides conquering. Military capacity is fixed, fungible, measurable, it sounds like economics, perfect information, rational, national, egoistic behavior. And so that leads us to understand unstable balances and stable balances. Unstable balances, I'll get to in just a moment, are things like tripolar arrangements. More stable ones, famously two great powers, if they dominate the international system, can provide a deterrent peace. This was an argument made long ago by Kenneth Waltz. And then there are other forms of balanced alliances, equipoise and counterpoise. And that dates all the way back to a Flemish advisor to Louis XI named Philippe de Comines, who developed the theory of equal alliances providing stability. And then last and least likely, those with very high defense ratios, so it takes three times of the offensive capability to conquer a state, and with a very low uncertainty. And as my colleague over there, Professor Kalonimos from Sciences Po, has written repeatedly, uncertainty is plagued in international politics, and a very rare occasion do you ever get certainty. So if you look at an unstable balance, tripolar balances are unstable because each of the three poles right over here will be tempted to ally in the Kaplan model with the other to conquer the third and divide it up. But since any of the combinations are possible, they will preempt and you'll get war. Very unstable. A more stable arrangement is over here on the right, where you have one great power, two smaller powers that are sufficiently large that if they combine in a regular alliance, will deter an attack from the larger power. So this is the ways in which the balance of power can provide a certain degree of stability, which some, Macmillan, Churchill, would call peace. That is, there's not a present incentive, preemptive incentive to war. Another model of peace that's also coercive comes right back to Karl Marx. His famous book article on the Civil War in France of 1871. It talks about transnational, across-border conflict and transnational cooperation. And his comments on the Commune in Paris says that the German capitalists were propping up the French capitalist, both thus oppressing the French working class. This is after the war broke out and after Bismarck's troops advanced on Paris. The Commune arose, and rather than see the Commune take over France, Bismarck's troops aligned with the Versailles old forces to repress the Commune. This is Marx's history, maybe not the most accurate, but it's his interpretation of what happened here in Paris in 1870 and 1871. Two quotations from Marx are, "Paris armed, is the revolution armed? The capitulation of Paris by surrendering to Prussia, not only Paris, but all France, initiated the civil war that's Thiers' Troisième République, were now to wage with the assistance of Prussia against the Republic of Paris. And further, while the European governments thus testified before Paris to the international character of class rule, they cry down the international counter-organization of labor against the cosmopolitan conspiracy of capital." So it's class war being waged across borders was Marx's understanding of what was happened here. So the French capitalist, the German capitalist, aligned together in peace, but only in order to oppress and destroy the French socialist. And the French socialist hoped for solidarity with socialists overseas. It did not emerge, and they were defeated in ways that we know well. I'm not attesting to the accuracy of Marx's history, but just this is his interpretation of international class war. Class war also takes place through art, through propaganda of art. And what you see right here is an engraving, very political, that identifies the communards as the enemies of France. They're seen right here assassinating the Archbishop of Paris, which did happen, knocking down the obelisk in the Place Vendôme. The artist Courbet was blamed for this in history. Burning the Tuileries, et cetera. And the real villains as part of this propaganda war are these women up in front, and they're carrying petrol with the flames to burn Paris. That was the assertion of the anti-communards. They especially identified women in this role. And this over here on the left is one of the pétroleuses, they're called. You see the pétrole right here, allegedly burning the city of Paris. One of the most famous of whom were then arrested was the communard here named Louise Michel, who commanded a battalion that included both men and women in the commune. She herself was alleged to be this kind of person. In fact, she was a very honorable commander. And she was in uniform. She was captured and then prosecuted as a communard, convicted for wearing a military uniform, which was a crime for women to do at this period. And then she was sent to New Caledonia as a prison island. When she got to New Caledonia, you'll be pleased to hear, she organized the locals up and opposed to French imperialism. And she made herself so obnoxious to the colonial authorities that they sent her back to France, at which she then founded the anarchist movement with Prince Kropotkin. She has been attributed as the inventor of the anarchist flag. I know that sounds like an oxymoron, but the flag is all black. She invented it. She had a long, successful career as a speaker and eventually retired. She's been honored in France by a metro stop on the Ligne 3 here in Paris. So she's been redeemed by history for her conviction as a communard. That's just two examples of other kinds of pieces, what I call unjust or coercive pieces. Now I want to move to just pieces, and I'm aware these are controversial, but these are, I think, important arguments. One, of course, is the Kantian liberal piece, and the other is the Rawlsian piece. The Kantian liberal piece is a self-enforcing piece based upon three definitive articles of a hypothetical treaty, a contract, if you will, among states that Kant encourages states to sign as a way to achieve a reliable peace. And this is in 1795. There are three definitive articles that he requires must be signed in order to achieve a peace. First is that the members must agree to be representative republics, that is, have a separation of powers, executive, legislative, judicial, and a representative legislature, one elected by the citizens. Remember, this is not as progressive as it sounds. Citizens for Kant were male property holders. No women, no one who was employed, only property holders. But nonetheless, it was an elected legislature. The second article is the Fatus Pacificum, which is the agreement on peace. It's an agreement on collective respect and mutual security, a treaty promising the non-use of force, but importantly, not an international state. This would only be a treaty. And third and lastly, cosmopolitan law, which is respect for all human beings and as persons, such that strangers are respected and greeted with hospitality when they show up on the shores of a country rather than hostility. And this then opens up the possibility of communications, understanding, and trade. They must be admitted if they are in danger of their life, but they otherwise need not be admitted. And Kant was a critic of imperialism, you might remember. And this is also the foundation of various forms of international humanitarian law, the Refugee Convention, and indeed, arguably, I was told by Mireille a number of years ago, when we discussed this, the beginning of the non-refoulement principle can be dated back to here. So that's Kant's hypothetical treaty. It's what we modern social scientists would call a self-enforcing peace. That is, it does not require external enforcement by a global state. It's enforced by the members themselves based upon their own rational, reasonable understanding of their interest and duties as states. And the famous paragraph is from paragraph one of part two of Perpetual Peace. And it goes as follows. If, as is inevitably the case, under this constitution, the consent of the citizens is required to decide whether or not war should be declared. It is a very natural that they will have a great hesitation in embarking on so dangerous an enterprise, calling down on themselves all the miseries of war, fighting, taxes, etc. But under a constitution where the subject is not a citizen, and which is therefore not Republican, it is the simplest thing in the world to go to war. For the head of state is not a fellow citizen, but the owner of the state, and war will not force him to make the slightest sacrifice so far as his banquets, hunts, pleasure palaces, and court festivals are concerned. He can thus decide on war without any significant reason as a kind of amusement, and unconcernedly leave it to the diplomatic corps, who are always ready for such purposes. As a formal diplomat, that's a little painful, to justify the war for the sake of propriety. And so he says that's the heart of why you will have a reliable peace among fellow republics who respect these three principles. Now, what are the virtues or the traits of liberal internationalism? First of all, there were very few liberal republics in 1795. There were two or three quasi-republics. In 1795, France, and by the way, very curiously, he was a defender of France despite the terror. That's a very confused argument for a liberal internationalist like Kant, but he was. He then gave up on France after the 18th Brumaire and the coups, etc. He noted Switzerland, and he noted the U.S., but the U.S. was, of course, half slave society and at best only half free. But he thought that those were the beginnings of what eventually would be a growing community of fellow republics inspired by the French experience to create a peace in Europe, which then might someday expand to the rest of the world. So maybe three in 1795. Today, Freedom House, an NGO, asserts that there are about 85 mostly democratic liberal republics in the world today. So despite the ups and downs of World War I, the Great Depression, fascism, communism, the number has grown over the centuries, but not yet complete. What are some of the virtues that social scientists have identified? One is an interstate democratic peace. Two liberal democratic republics are very unlikely to war against each other. There are a small handful of exceptions. Democratic republics are less likely to suffer a civil war, though we know that they have. If the U.S. was a republic in 1861, we certainly did. They're less likely to engage in genocide. But again, it's not absolutely ruled out. Empirical republics, in a very non-Kantian way, some of whom have been racist and have engaged in genocide. And they're much less likely to suffer a distribution-based famine because the government steps in to correct that, according to at least a study by Amartya Sen, which is relatively well known. So those are the virtues. One wishes one could stop at the virtues, but unfortunately there are also identifiable pathologies attached to liberal internationalism. And I bring a special attention to two. One is aggression, imprudent hostility toward powerful non-democratic states. Now, some of these wars are purely defensive because the non-democratic states attacked the liberal republics, but others are not. And we can think of many, including parts of the US-Soviet Cold War, which was exacerbated by anti-communist ideology coming from the capitalist liberal republics of the post-World War II period. And also unjustified aggression, particularly against weak non-liberal states. We can think of European colonization during the periods in which they had Republican-style government, or, to be more contemporaneous, the many U.S. interventions, as in Iran, 53, unfortunately we're back, Guatemala, Cuba, Dominican Republic, Vietnam, the list could go on and on of aggressions by liberal republics against weak non-liberal states in order to protect interest of capital or for ideological reasons, fear of Cold War communism takeovers like Guatemala and the Dominican Republic and others. So that's one pathology, excess security-driven, ideologically motivated, materially inspired by protecting capitalism, et cetera, interventions. The second pathology is a failure to assist peoples in desperate need of assistance from things like famine, diseases, all sorts of other harms that can afflict populations. And if you're a liberal republic committed to values associated with hospitality and the recognition of human dignity and the duty to provide solidarity, this is a major failure as well. So these are the two predominant, there are others, pathologies that I think can be associated with liberal internationalism. This is where John Rawls comes in. One of the great liberal philosophers of the second half of the 20th century. He wrote A Theory of Justice, an absolutely foundational work on the nature of justice in 1971. His last book was about international justice called The Law of Peoples. And he proposed that liberal democracies would get together and hypothetically engage in a contract agreed to by and for themselves to create a system of law amongst themselves. And this would be a realistic utopia, something that was both utopian, it would be a matter of duty, but also realistic, that can be assumed to be feasible if we look at the world around us. And of course, Rawls was inspired by Jean-Jacques Rousseau and his famous line that laws should be designed for men as they are and laws as they should be. I won't try to put that into French, but the inspiration of Rousseau is clear from the paperback edition of The Law of Peoples. The statue that he has on the paperback edition is Rousseau on the small island in Geneva. Rousseau identified as a citoyen de Genève, as his only claim to a title. And there's a statue that commemorates him where the Rhone River flows from the Lake of Geneva into the river and down to Lyon. And so that was his inspiration. So what are these laws that liberal peoples should agree to, according to Rawls? And there are these eight right here. Peoples are free and independent and should be respected. They're supposed to observe treaties and undertakings. Peoples are equal and parties to the agreements that bind them. Peoples are to observe a duty of non-intervention. They have a right to self-defense, but no right to instigate war for reasons other than self-defense. Peoples are to honor human rights, observed restrictions in the conduct of war. And eight, peoples have a duty to assist other peoples living under unfavorable conditions that prevent their having a just and decent political regime. Any lawyers in this room will know that this is absolutely ordinary international law. This is the UN Charter and international humanitarian law, the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties. Nothing unusual until you get to point eight. Peoples have a duty to assist. One wishes there were an international duty to assist today, but there is not yet a duty to assist. So what should we make of the realism? Again, point one, it's very modest. This simply describes UN Charter law, international humanitarian law. And Rawls's claim is that it's not just a normative ideal, but it's to be reasonably expected in the relations among fellow liberal republics. The big question mark is how you extend it to other states. So it's otherwise very modest. Its realism also rests on the Kantian liberal democratic peace. We have empirical evidence that ordinary old republics tend to maintain peace with each other. So, of course, they'll follow most of the rules of law that I just described. No interventions, honoring treaties, etc. But ordinary liberalism, which I've just described, does not include, and the big question mark here is, can Rawls cure or address equal respect and tolerance for non-liberal peoples that also respect basic human rights? That is, can he get away from that trap of excessive liberal aggression in the world, especially against small non-liberal states? And can he address the question of the duty of assistance? That is, providing assistance to peoples in desperate need. Again, the two pathologies of ordinary liberal internationalism. And I would, before I move ahead, I'd move to the point that Rawls is a normative theory. It's political philosophy, moral philosophy. But it was very important to him that his theory be a realistic utopia, one that's achievable. That was quite important to him. And when he delivered the lectures on the Law of Peoples, I was a professor at Princeton at the time, and he invited me to a long evening that we spent in the bar of the Nassau Inn. There's a pub down in the basement. And we talked at great length. He didn't need any philosophic advice from me, but he said, are there peoples for whom this is a reasonable set of expectations? And we spent the evening talking about that. So, first of all, he widens respect to include decent hierarchical peoples, a category that in the book he calls Kazanistans. He could have come up with a better label, frankly, but what he's attempting to signal is that there were certain Islamic societies that were hierarchical, non-democratic, but could still be considered to be worthy of tolerance and respect by a liberal state, a liberal people. And this was trying to get at that pathology of excess interventionism against non-democratic peoples. And so he talks about a group of societies called decent hierarchical peoples or societies. There have been various attempts to code. I coded them first in 2006. It was a good book by Annette Furster, and she has a slightly different coding. Other people have taken up this debate. What are these societies? They're non-aggressive, he argues by assumption. Second of all, they respect basic human rights. That is, which and which not, they respect subsistence and basic liberty. No slavery or serfdom, a rule of law, a common good ideal of justice. There needs to be protection from freedom of conscience, thought, property, religious toleration. But importantly, these are not liberal democratic states or peoples. There's no equality of religions. You can have a private exercise of your religion, but not necessarily publicly. There's no equality for genders. Many of these societies that he had in mind potentially might discriminate against women. And no equal political rights. These were not democracies. Instead, they had consultation mechanisms. Groups were consulted and represented, but not elected, and consulted before policies were undertaken that were relevant to them. And the leaders would respond to dissent, not necessarily follow it. And in a paper that I have, we talk about the Shura in Bahrain and Oman and various other institutions that do something like this. Decent hierarchical people should be tolerated, respected, not pressured to change by liberal republics, though they can be criticized. So he's attempting to open the door to toleration beyond the typical ideological line drawing of liberal internationalism. And so he was concerned about realism. So one of the things that I did beginning in 2006 and then recently last year in 2025 is attempting to code states that might reasonably be judged to fit his expectations. And I did so in 2005 with a former student named Ihsan Doramash, and again in 2025 with two former students, Abdullah Al-Haroun and Bhavna Rajan. And we identified six in 2025 on the left, Nepal, Thailand, Morocco, Jordan, Qatar, and Oman. Some partial, you know, near the UAE, Bahrain, Kuwait, and then no for Saudi Arabia, did not qualify. Let me go back. You would note these different colors. The coding with Isan in 2006 was different. There's a lot of instability in these peoples. Some that were not, like Nepal, Thailand, and Morocco in 2006, now are. And some that were, like the UAE, Bahrain, Kuwait, have become less, more problematic in this dimension. So a lot of instability. I'm just showing you this. I'm not going to go into this. It just shows you that we were painstaking in our coding. We had all sorts of criteria. We measured against quantitative and other databases. That doesn't mean we're right. And so if any of you disagree with the coding, send me an email, and I'll happily go back and do it again to check it. But we did make an effort to code this extensively. Another category that Rawls creates, in addition to decent hierarchical peoples who should be respected, is that he refines better what it means to be a genuine liberal democracy. The coding that many of us are used for Kantian republics is pretty loose. It includes all sorts of electoral, capitalist, constitutional republics. But Rawls said that's not enough. To be a real democracy, you need to show respect for equal citizenship and the equal respect due to persons. And he has, on page 50 of his book, five criteria, including a fair equality of opportunity, especially in education and training. Education should not be barred to people without large amounts of money. We Americans charge a lot of money to go to our elite universities. That would not qualify. You need a decent distribution of income so that the differences in income are not so large that they lead to disrespect among citizens, and so that all citizens can participate according to their life plans within a democratic society. You need a guarantee that society is the employer of last resort through various different means to provide long-term security. And again, equal respect among citizens, given how important a job is to respect in a modern capitalist society. You need a provision of basic health care for all, again, so that citizens can participate. You need public funding of elections to reduce the danger of capture by private lobbies, and again, to help provide the information and independence needed for genuine democratic majorities to effectively rule. And so my colleagues and I also coded advanced liberal democracies. You see the list of 15 full democracies and 11 partial. You may note France is included among them. This coding was done before I accepted the invitation from Professor Besson to join you today. But all of these are subject to dispute. And again, Abdullah Alaroun and Babna Rajan helped me with all of this. Again, the same coding format. We went in detail onto all of the Rawlsian criteria, put together the best information that we could. This is just a sample of the coding for Finland, for example. Here's the now question. Does it make a difference that we now have a new category of decent hierarchical peoples that should be tolerated and never intervened against? And do we have a difference that we have a more refined understanding of what a genuine liberal democracy is? And that's the question. We looked, is there more toleration of decent hierarchical peoples by these, what I call, advanced liberal democracies? Well, note there are no wars between the DHPs and the advanced liberal democracies, indeed between any democracies. But it's very hard, and we tried a number of times to code respect. We attempted to code speeches and things such as this, but we haven't yet succeeded in coding the idea of respect among states. One should. But let me note a couple other things with the advanced liberal democracies that lean us in the direction of them being more peaceful, genuine democracies. In the domestic rule of law, advanced liberal democracies are 18 of the top 20 in the global rule of law index. That has to do with whether courts operate freely, the police are less abusive, things such as that. And note the rule of law index is an index about the rule of law that does not overlap with the advanced liberal democracies coding. These are two separate data sets, and nevertheless, 18 of the top 20 are the advanced liberal democracies. Internationally, the ALDs are all members of the ICC. Only Japan, Denmark, and the UK and the Netherlands allowed themselves to be listed among the coalition of the willing supporting the 2003 invasion of Iraq. None of the others did. The average global peace index, which is a highly complicated measure of peace dealing with violence both internationally and domestically, is much higher for the advanced liberal democracies. And the global militarism index, which divides defense budget by social welfare spending, is much lower than the OECD average among other wealthy democracies. So these are some indications of leaning in a Pacific direction. And here I'm getting close to wrapping up. Are they more, the advanced liberal democracies, more generous in dealing with the duty of assistance? Now, Rawls does not argue for global equal redistribution of income, unlike some philosophers, cosmopolitan philosophers, who believe that the Rawlsian, so to speak, difference principle, egalitarian principle, should apply across borders. He argues that that is not necessary, but you do have a duty of assistance to individuals, persons experiencing an immediate threat to their life, like from famines, natural disasters, and others. And our hypothesis is that this duty is not being met today in the world when we look around, and that it requires not just money, but it does require money in order to provide that kind of assistance to the victims of genocides, of other slaughters, of famines, diseases, etc. And if you look at the green states here, those are the advanced liberal democracies, measuring ODA as a percentage of GNI, gross national income. So again, the advanced liberal democracies, by and large, are among the best global citizens when it comes to the duty of assistance. So the argument I'm making is that Rawls, who was very concerned about a degree of realism for his ideal normative theory, should have been relaxed. There is some evidence to support his intuitions in view of the fact that DHPs would be respected and that advanced liberal democracies would be somewhat more pacific and somewhat more generous than typical liberal capitalist republics. So let me conclude. I think I can conclude the more a democracy looks like a Rawlsian advanced liberal democracy, the more likely it is to be peaceful and meet the duty of assistance. I think I conclude from this. But I know there are social scientists here in the room, so I want to make it very clear that this is not a proof in any sense of Rawlsian just peace. It's what we call a plausibility probe in social sciences, meaning that there's no experimental treatment of these questions, not even quasi-experimental. It's not multivariate. These are simply two-by-two table comparisons. For the economists, there are no instrumental variables to avoid insignificant correlations. It's just an attempt to identify elective affinities that might make it more likely than not that Rawls's intuitions from 1999 should be treated with a degree of credibility until we can devise better ways to test his propositions. So let me thank you for your attention. I'm honored to be here at the Collège de France, and I look forward to any comments or questions that you might have. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.